Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'm joined today by Dr. Bob Gwyther, who will be filling in for Dr. Christy Page, who is away on vacation. And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Maxine Janisse, dental hygienist and assistant professor at Northern Arizona University, about oral health needs of Native Americans.
Well, we're really glad to have Dr. Bob Gwyther again with us today, a co-host on the show, substituting for Dr. Page, who's out on vacation. Good to have you with us again, Dr. Gwyther.
Thanks, Adam. It's good to be with you.
And we've got some interesting research that matters. That turns out that we've got a couple research that on teens and young kids. Let's talk about our very first research. Let's just dive right in here, which is about child care facilities and eating and physical activity. Not for teenagers or even for elementary school. This is the child care for the 3 and 4 year old kids. Tell us about what do you know about this, Dr. Gwyther?
Well, essentially, I think that it's looking at whether children that age will benefit from a healthy diet and being physically active,
Which is common sense. I mean, that's like, who wouldn't benefit from a little bit of physical activity every day and eating well, right?
Right. And especially little kids need physical exercise. They just want to do it. And also, are vegetables and fruits better than eating chips and crackers and stuff like that? And I think the answer we all sort of believe in the profession is they are. They're more nutritious and less likely to produce obesity. They just cost more money. And there comes the rub.
Yeah, well, and so this article was in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, actually done by researchers at University of North Carolina, near and dear to us, working in conjunction with some researchers at Minnesota and Duke University. And they looked at 42 studies kind of in the research literature about what do we know in the literature about this issue, including what do we know in terms of legislation and health policy and any studies that have been done to try to improve the situation.
And really, it seems like the thing to do is get kids started early on good eating habits, and hopefully they'll pick that up and then adapt that for their lives. Also, having a opportunity to go outside and tear around or do exercise indoors somehow needs to be made possible in the facility.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, there's this belief that, well, maybe these childcare facilities are not really should be worried about this. But you know what? We could say the same thing about hospitals. We shouldn't worry about what we eat in hospitals or at the work site, the types of food. And we know that those policies that are done in employment places help us do these things better. Absolutely. I see no reason why it couldn't be the response, help these child care centers do the same thing.
I agree.
Well, let's think about our next research that matters. This is a study, believe it or not, it was in Pediatrics, a very prestigious journal, looking at young kids in cartoons, and does it matter what they're watching in terms of how they actually think after they watch the study?
And they compared three different activities. One is watching episodes of SpongeBob SquarePants, one that I've seen a lot with my grandchildren. And then the second one is a little tamer cartoon. I may pronounce this right. I think it's Kailu.
Uh-huh.
And watch some of that. And then the third one is just free drawing with pencil and paper or pens. And then they had them do a task after each of those things to see which one would work the best.
Right. And this is, they did it, you know, for about 9 or 10 minutes each. And the tests were actually some, you know, cognitive mental function tests to see how well these kids could follow rules, how much they could solve a problem and remember what they're told. For instance, don't do that. Don't get away from the oven there. All seemingly really important things. And what they found were significant differences in what these kids could do depending on which of the two different cartoons and or the drawing.
And it turns out that SpongeBob, which they characterize as kind of a fast-paced, frenetic, often
unrealistic for the kids.
Right. Disjointed thing did the worst by far. And Kaloo, which is not as fast-paced and unrealistic, the children were able to perform better. And yeah, the ones that had the free hand drawing were able to do the best.
Yeah, and these were really significant. 15% passed problem solving if they watched SpongeBob. 35% of the Kaloo viewers and 70% of those who were drawing. I found this actually pretty – I thought this is just ridiculous, you know. But when I'm looking at the study now, I'm going, wow, I think I like this, and that it really suggests that it's not easy, but drawing is better than the TV for lots of kids.
Yeah. And, you know, it isn't as though the kid is being entertained by watching the screen. It's they're entertaining themselves by doing something creative.
Yep. Yep. Well, I think hopefully that's important for you as well. And our last one, just real quickly, is a study about the sleep habits and what happens if you try to catch up on sleep for the teenagers on weekends, published in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine.
And they actually did this in Korea and had some 2,600 high school kids. And they found that they only got, on average, 5 hours and 42 minutes of sleep on the weekdays. And
amazing. that to me really was like, oh, true. My God.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think we all think 7 to 9 is where kids that age ought to be sleeping in order to maintain their sleep debt.
And they had 3 more hours on weekends, but apparently there was something about that catching up sleep. Not like they didn't need more sleep because they were sleep deprived, but that alone doesn't work. That alone doesn't get these kids back to where they need to be, which I think is important. I don't know the answer here, Bob, but I think paying more attention to sleep and teenagers and better sleep hygiene. I don't know. What do you think? Anything else?
I think it's clearly important, and people to do the best need to be rested when they start their activities in the day. And, you know, most kids in this society have to get up and go to school during the day, so they can't sleep in late. And then they don't make it up on the weekends, and so the performance basically suffers.
Yeah.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and then when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Maxine Janisse, a dental hygienist and assistant professor at Northern Arizona University.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and my co-host today, Dr. Bob Gwyther. And today on Conversations, Bob, we're going to be talking with Maxine Janisse, dental hygienist and assistant professor at Northern Arizona University, about oral health needs of Native Americans. Professor Janisse is part of a study team that has been documenting the really sad, I would say, oral health conditions that are existing on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and we'll be talking in broader terms about what can be done. Welcome to Your Health, Professor Janisse.
Thank you.
Maybe you could just start out with us. Tell us a little bit about you and your interest in Native American oral health and how you came to be interested in this really condition, which is really pressing.
Well, I'm a tribal member. I'm American Indian. I'm from the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is the location where we did the study. But I'm American Indian, and I've always had my primary focus has always been looking at, as a registered dental hygienist, looking at health disparities among our tribal community, within our tribal communities. And so I've always had an interest in, you know, what are the issues and what are the challenges that our tribal people are facing within, you know, their health care delivery system in these communities, in these respective communities.
Well, I gathered from an article you wrote for Health Affairs that you went out to the Pine River Reservation with some other people and actually went out into the community, into some of the clinics and some people's homes, and did an assessment of the state of their dental health. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Yeah, what we did was we went out into the community, and when we're talking about public health practice and public health interventions, those don't primarily happen right, in the clinic. You have to go to the community. And to really get a true assessment of what the needs are of the community, you have to go, because, again, time and time again, as we went out into community, it was, I can't access services for whatever reason, their socioeconomic status is such that, they don't have financial means to even make it to the clinic.
Well, Professor Chenise, let me just ask a question, but I know we want to get into the study, but help our listeners understand, because I was amazed. I know that you're Lakota Sioux and that you were on the Pine Ridge Reservation, South Dakota, but describe for us a little bit about, just help us visualize what is the reservation there, because I think my picture was this was a place that you could just go and you would come back to, and you might be maybe driving an hour and you'd be back, but that's not really what it is.
Well, historically, if, we want to step back a little bit, these are lands that, of course, the U.S. government, as a result of treaties that were made, with lands that were taken away from us, we were placed on these reservations. And so it's a place where primarily tribal community members, tribal people from that respective tribe live. So it borders, it sits within the state of, for example, South Dakota. It borders, it's a pocket of land that sits within a state.
But huge. Yeah, this is, I think in your article you say it's the size of Connecticut.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that to me is really quite amazing when one thinks about trying to provide services. And it's also, I imagine it's fairly rural and remote, and the distances between populations, even on the reservation, may be very large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you have communities that live on the reservation. So community members live in what we call districts. And so you'll have a population that lives within this district. And, some people live out in, the very rural areas of these districts. But it's a land base that we were placed on, and that's where we do, we live and practice our traditions. But one of the challenges is that we don't have any, our limited economic resources are not there. We don't have banks on our reservations. We don't have malls on our reservations. All the things that you normally see in a community, for example, in Denver, any town. So we live on these reservations, and then we have to go to the border towns to conduct our business.
One of the statistics you have in your article is that there's two dental hygienists for 40,000 reservation residents, whereas in most societies you'd be seeing one dental hygienist for every 2,000 people. So that's really a scarce resource there.
Absolutely. And so, you think of this practitioner whose primary role is to provide preventative services, and you only have two of them. How are you able to, how is the population able to access services, given those limited resources of manpower?
And you point out in the article that you found very large percentages of adults, especially the older adults, but even a high percentage of children have dental caries problems, teeth missing, a variety of dental issues that you found. And I'm wondering, my kind of ignorance about this is, that hasn't always been a problem of the Lakota people. I mean, does that date back to being put on the reservations, and prior to that, dental health was better, or do we even know that?
We had this conversation the other day, but our diets were so different back before the reservation era. Back before we were placed on reservations. Our diet was highly protein, meat. When we were placed on reservations, the diet changed. Because we were not able to do what we normally did as a people you know, the hunting and the gathering. And so you had an infusion of high-carb flours, white flour, you know, all those things that, to me, impact your health. And they're called commodity foods on our reservation. And that's what we were introduced to. And so our diet changed.
You know, you in addition to the changes in the diet, this environmental issue of the distances involved. You also describe a structural problem, which was something as simple as you have three clinics on this reservation the size of Connecticut, but yet it's not just so easy just to come make an appointment. You have to call. Describe to our listeners the difficulties that you discover just structurally in people needing to make phone calls for appointments.
Well, what you have to do, the system is set up in such a way that you can get an appointment. It's called a same-day appointment. But the same-day appointment oftentimes is limited to maybe 10 people, or walk-in emergency is that is limited to 10 people. But the practice has been that on Tuesday morning, once a month, between 8 and maybe 10 o'clock, you as a patient need to call in. And so here you are sitting there trying to call in for an appointment, but everybody else is trying to call in too. And so once the however many slots they have open at the clinic for that month, those appointments are filled, then you have to try again next month and see if you can get an appointment. And this was the story that we heard routinely as we were out doing our survey is, you know, I try to call in, I can't get an appointment, you know. Or if they finally answer, it's our appointments are all full.
I know that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has some administrative responsibility for healthcare systems there. Are they responsive to this?
It's not the Bureau of Indian Affairs, it's the Indian Health Service.
Mm.
Yeah, and so it's the Indian Health Service, and I mean, it's such a large, you know, large organization. The Indian Health Service provides care, I mean, is responsible for health care delivery for, we have 500 and some tribes. Federally recognized tribes. Many of those have reservations or on reservations lands within, you know, the different states. And I mean, it's a huge system that, I mean, I don't want to in any way. I have a great deal of respect for the healthcare providers that do what they do on our reservations. But you know, the system needs to. The system is sort of broken right now.
Well, and if you only have two dental hygienists for three clinics for 40,000 people, there's something that needs to be
Absolutely.
Fixed there. But we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Professor Maxine Janisse, dental hygienist and assistant professor at Northern Arizona University, about oral health needs of Native Americans. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and my co-host today, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We've been talking with Professor Maxine Janisse about oral health needs of Native Americans. And Professor Janisse, maybe you could give us an example or two. I know you, in this article, really a really important article in Health Affairs, you talk really about the needs on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And it is the poorest reservation in the United States, but you also let us know that this is problems that exist on many reservations. And give us an example. You had a story about coming up to a house where one of the tribe members had 10 foster children. Can you tell us about that story?
Yeah. Well, initially we had gone to a home where There was a family that was taken in foster children. So we went there initially and did our screening and talked to the families. And then oftentimes there's multi-generational families living in one house. And so it's not unusual to find 18 to 20 people living within a three-bedroom home. I mean, it wasn't unusual.
And here you're bringing some mobile dental tables and trying to do assessments in their homes.
Yeah, and we had it was a lawn chair that we bought at Walmart, one of the reclining chairs that they have, and that's what we would use. But if we didn't have room to take the chair in there, we would just use one of their chairs, kitchen chairs, or whatever they had available.
And many of these children had not necessarily had access to dental services before. Maybe some of them hadn't had dental exams before.
No, not their patient activation probably was that time, which some of them could have been 11 or 12 years old.
And what kind of problems did you discover?
We found that children had the presence of decay. Sometimes they had areas where it was an active infection, and they were not able to receive services, and that was really alarming.
And some of them would be losing teeth earlier than they would normally or should be?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, when they finally would get in, if they were able to get in, oftentimes, that could involve an extraction rather than saving a tooth.
You had one touching story of a young single father with two children, two young girls age 4 and 5, and how he'd had so many of his teeth extracted, he vowed that wouldn't happen, but despite his best efforts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when we would go into a home, and of course I speak my Lakota language, and there are many Lakota-speaking people in our communities, and so, as a Lakota speaker, I can go into a home and immediately build relationships with people because they know that I'm from the community. So then when we would go into the homes, I would say, well, do you have anybody else that, we might be able to do some screenings on? And it was like the community was like, well, call this person. And then we've come in there, and oftentimes our cell phones don't work. And they have cell phones that work, and so they would call for us and set up our next place where we could go do some screening. And so, in that respect, I mean, the tribal members were really the drivers in, bringing this issue of, oral health and the challenges and the disparities and the access. I mean, it was the community that was driving this.
Well, let's talk about the challenges a little bit, because I remember when I did a mission to the in the former Soviet Union, Ukraine, and I went with a dentist, and we went in, and I remember the dentist I hear was focused on the healthcare, medical, and the dentist had brought little presents to all the kids first and had given them all yo-yos and then got them to do their dental exams. It reminds me of you bringing toothbrushes and I can just see the smiles of having toothbrushes, but it's more than just getting people toothbrushes.
Yeah. You know what was disturbing for me just initially, just because I'm from, I'm from a tribal community. I'm a member of this community. I'm a member of this reservation. And so initially when we were talking about incentives and what should we bring, as incentives, and someone said, one of the investigators said, well, we're going to bring toothbrushes. And I thought to myself, we're going through all of this, and all they get is a toothbrush. After I went into the community and realized that sometimes it is a toothbrush that we just need because we can't even afford to buy one. And I had totally a different shift in my thinking, because I was thinking, that's all they get. And because I wanted more from my tribal members.
Sure. I understand that feeling and the urge and hearing from you and the desperate needs and wanting to provide those, but what would you give them?
You know, I was you know, my thought was, you know, let's give them an incentive like $20 to get gas to get to a clinic is what I had thought. And when we went into these communities and talked to people and gave a toothbrush, gave toothpaste, that was welcome. Thank you. And we even had children starting to brush their teeth. I mean, you know, and it, you know, it's a simple act, but, you know, I mean, it was meaningful because, you know, now I could see that, you know, they really do have some challenges on my reservation. I mean, if you can't, if, you know, you can't go buy a toothbrush and you have to, you know, travel 2 hours to go grocery shopping, 2 hours to go, I mean, buy your supplies for a month or whatever. You know, I mean, those are challenges that, you know, these community members are facing, these troubled people are facing.
And what about the challenge of providing, of having more providers? How do you have some interesting suggestions about how to meet those challenges? Because it's clear we need 10 times the number of dental hygienists at least to meet some of the needs.
Well, it would be nice if we could reshape policy in such a way that we, at our institution here at the university, we have Native American Indian graduates who sometimes can't get, you know, jobs on our reservation because the jobs are not there. And the jobs are not there because we have policymakers that have not recognized that, you know, if we can embed in these communities, these providers, we might be able to make an impact on the disparities that we're facing. But, you know, we have to, you know, go back to Washington and, you know, say, you know, this is what we need in these tribal communities. These health care providers can make a significant impact, just create the jobs for them. So,
well, you know, I think those are really important issues. Maybe before we conclude, maybe you could share with us just a thought or two about what this has meant for you being a Lakota Native and coming back and serving your people. You describe some of the values of the Native American culture in your article. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about some of those values and how you see this work in its spiritual dimension.
Well, you know, as I mean, we have many cultural practices on our reservation. And, you know, the cultural practices and the traditions are all grounded in, you know, a sense of community, a sense of taking care of one another, a sense of giving back to community. And, you know, I just want to state that, you know, even though I'm off the reservation, I'm still giving back to my community because I'm opening doors of opportunity for others to come and receive an education, and then return to your, you know, return to their respective communities as Native people. And so, you know, I'm still contributing to that, although I'm not on my ancestral lands, which are the Pine Ridge Reservation. But some of the things that, you know, really ground me to the reservation and create the human being that I am is the sense of, you know, what we've been taught, and it means that we have to always look back 7 generations and, you know, what did our ancestors give to us that we need to give back to community, but also looking 7 generations ahead and say, you know, what is the legacy that we want to leave behind? And that's just central in the philosophy, the ideology, the teachings of tribal people. So it's always that sense of giving back to community. What do you need to do to give back to community?
Well, Professor Janus, it would seem like you're doing this article for Health Affairs is a great step in the first, maybe the first of some direction that can get moving to address a very important healthcare need on your reservation.
Well, I sure hope so, because we just are not, we're not moving. We're kind of staying in a place, but I think think we need to, our trajectory needs a boost.
We really thank you for sharing all this with us, and I hope that that is the first step in what winds up being a lot of services that become available.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we will be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Well, for House Calls today, Bob, we've got some really interesting questions. We've got a question from a listener that's concerned about mononucleosis because they have fatigue.
Somebody that has some burning when they urinate, and they want to know what it is because their urinalysis did not look like a urinary tract infection.
It may not be a urinary tract infection. We have a question about bee pollen, and we'll tell you what we know and don't know. And then finally,
a billing question. Somebody went in for a physical exam that should have been covered by their insurance.
And it wasn't.
But
now, let's take a listen to our very first question today about someone who might have mono.
I was told by my doctor that I have mono because I have fatigue and an elevated EBV test, but I have never had a fever or a sore throat. Do I really have mono?
Well, that's interesting. Do they really have mono? I'm not so certain.
Mono, acute mononucleosis is generally accompanied by a fever, sore throat, strange smell
pause
of the
breath.
Pause
in the back of your mouth. Yeah, and, yeah, really sick.
A lot of lymph nodes usually. So really kind of a sick disease.
And fatigue is part of that, but fatigue is also part of, that's probably
many.
The largest possibility, hundreds of different possibilities.
And so somebody drew a so-called Epstein-Barr virus or EBV test, which was positive, but
the causative virus of mono.
Of mono,
which
right.
seems reasonable.
It does, except there's two ways to measure that. Does somebody have it acutely, and that's a mono spot test, measuring IgM reactions, or have they had it sometime in the past and they have a positive IgG immunoglobulin?
These are antibodies that you can measure when you have an infection, and some of them will rise acutely. And that's that mono spot test when you go into the doctor versus the ones that kind of you had it and there those antibodies or those reactions are there for the rest of your life. And that's that EBV titer test, which just sounds like this patient may have had, which indicates you had mono or exposed to this perhaps at some point in time in your life, even if you never had mono, which a lot of people have.
And every time somebody checks your EBV, if that's the case, it'll be positive.
Because most of us have had some exposure to this virus in our lifetimes.
Right.
But it sounds like for this particular person that they didn't have the clinical symptoms. So you think their fatigue might be related to something else.
Yeah, and there's a long list of things that can cause that, all the way from low thyroid hormone to depression. So plenty of people have that symptom.
Yeah, so we're going to encourage you to go work with your provider, go back to your provider, maybe do a little bit broader workup. Maybe don't accept the diagnosis, at least without some further testing, because we're a little bit we're uncertain. Well, let's listen to our very next question. Actually, we have someone else, another patient who's a little bit uncertain. They thought they had a urinary tract infection, but maybe they did not.
I went to the doctor recently with burning when I urinate. My urinalysis, however, did not show an infection, I was told. So now I know I do not have a urinary tract infection. But what do I have?
What do you think, Bob? This is a question which we don't, you know, usually someone comes in, they say, oh, it burns when I urinate. We kind of think in our own minds, that's a urinary tract infection, but let's get a urinalysis, and we check it. Huh, it's negative?
So the urinalysis of a person with a bladder infection or kidney infections has a lot of white cells in it. Sometimes it's got some bacteria in it, and there are certain chemical tests that should show positive.
And when those aren't, it's like a surprise to us as it would be to the patient.
Right, because it's not the common thing. And then you have to think, well, there's a long list of things that actually can make it hurt when you urinate. And those vary from things that can cause the urethra, that's the final tube that carries urine to the outside, to be irritated or inflamed. That can happen from trauma. It can happen from chafing. And there are some unusual things that can cause people to have urinary pain too, for instance, interstitial cystitis.
Yeah, that's an interesting condition that we don't talk about. I know we haven't talked about it on this show before, but it's like inflammation in the bladder that's not as a result of infection. And it's actually pretty common. A lot of people can have this, women more than men. And it can start maybe after someone's had a bladder infection or surgery or an injury, and they have to go to the bathroom a lot, and it does burn, and it is painful. So it kind of mimics a bladder infection, and sometimes you could even have a little bit of blood, but it's not infection.
And to be certain of that one, you have to have a look with a cystoscope and see what the bladder epithelium looks like on the inside.
Cystoscope, that is not a fun thing necessarily to have done where a urologist looks inside the bladder.
With a light source and a little tube.
A little tube.
Yeah, and finds out.
It's not, little makes it sound like it's not so bad.
Well, yeah, it's not a big tube, but it's probably not real comfortable
yeah.
either.
So perhaps talk about and see about what else it could be, because it's not enough just to say what it's not. It's important to find out what it is sometimes, because there are some things that can be done to help get this treated if there are certain medications that you're taking or certain things that you're drinking that causing you to have this problem, you would want to stop them. So hopefully that's helpful. Let's take a listen to our very next house call about bee pollen.
I have a cold recently, and I heard that bee pollen is a good supplement to take to help get rid of it quicker. Is that true? And if so, where do you get it?
Well, Bob, are you a regional expert on bee pollen?
No, sir. Bee pollen is one of those nutraceuticals that gets sold in health food stores and other places.
A nutraceutical meaning as compared
classified as something one eats, and it's kind of like Nutra means kind of it's in the food category.
Nutrients.
But this is not controlled by the FDA or
Food
something.
Drug Administration. So these aren't right. the medications that we would normally prescribe. You wouldn't find allopathic physicians like us prescribing bee pollen usually.
That's correct.
And what about if, as a nutraceutical, we know something about it, don't we? Or what it's purportedly used for?
I guess we can look up what's in it. So frankly, you know, most medical students in allopathic medical schools like UNC's are not trained in these sorts of things very much. But you can pull out the sheet and find out what's in it. What is in it is the pollen that's brushed off the back of bees.
And it's off also, their behinds.
Also said perhaps to have a little bee saliva in it too. The question is, what does it help? And it's been recommended for lots of things, but there isn't.
Ranging from alcoholism to asthma and allergies or stomach problems.
And I had several relatives who took it for their allergies, and they couldn't say that it helped them very much.
Well, it does contain antioxidants and vitamins, but I guess the question is that these are the same antioxidants and vitamins that are in our regular diet or a multivitamin.
Right.
And those things are regulated, and you know what you're getting, and you're not getting things that could be harmful.
Right. And actually, a lot of people are allergic to pollens, and so to give them pollen could be risky because that can cause allergic reactions, including anaphylaxis.
Yeah, people who die or have to go into the emergency room because they can't breathe because they're allergic to this pollen, like ragweed and the fall pollens, yeah. I don't think it's something that, because there's no evidence that it actually, that there's good, any evidence that it actually improves something. I don't think I would be out there recommending it.
And I wouldn't either.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's hopefully helpful for you. Certainly not for a sore throat. Let's listen to our very last house call, a very important topic.
I had a physical exam with my doctor recently, and I expected the visit would be covered completely by my insurance, as a well-person exam is part of my benefit. When I spoke to my doctor about it, he talked about my high cholesterol and my arthritis in my back, saying that those conditions are part of his care for that visit too, and those are what he called modifiers. I have no idea what that means, but I'm pretty upset that I received a bill for $126 over and above what the insurance covered. Is that normal?
And this one's not terribly uncommon in my life, because doctors' bills are developed based on codes that they enter onto their encounter form generally.
And doctors also don't know really fully when you come in as a listener, as a patient, what your full range of insurance is and what's covered and what's not covered. We're just kind of trying to do what we can to take care of you in the time that we have.
Right. And so lots of people have different companies, and even within a company, there are multitudinous numbers of plans. So we don't keep that in our head. So this caller apparently had physical exam stuff covered, but perhaps not some of the other things that got billed.
If they actually had medical diagnoses.
Right. And the physician spent time doing that and included those codes on the bill, and therefore she got stuck for $126. And I can certainly understand how frustrating that is, particularly if when you go in the office, your expectation is that you've got this benefit for a physical exam that's covered, and you're here, you get another bill for something else.
But I think as a the patient, our listener, would be pretty frustrated too if the doctor said, well, you have to come back for a separate visit to talk about your cholesterol and the medications you're taking for arthritis, because I can't really talk about them today, or I'd have to bill you for it.
Yeah.
Is that the conversation we should be having?
Well, it is the conversation we should be having, I think, to be sure. But most people don't want to leave work twice or get their kids taken care of twice or whatever it takes to make two visits when they could do one. Our medical director is always talking about doing today's work today. And I think that ultimately, that's a good thing to do.
Well, and hopefully that's helpful for you. And maybe a reminder for us to have a conversation with you, our listeners and patients, about what we know and maybe sometimes what we don't know about what's going to be covered. And so it's an informed decision between the two of us. Well, we've had a chance to talk about and answer some questions here about these modifiers and the diagnosis, about bee pollen, about Epstein-Barr virus.
And about what the possible range of things are if you have some burning when you're urinating.
Yep. Well, that will conclude our house calls for today.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.